Good morning. The House Entrance Select Committee on Education for Wednesday, October 4th is convening. Once again, we welcome Representative Comp to the committee. Thank you. Sit in with us. We have a couple of absences excused, and we will proceed with our first panel, first individual, and that would be Karin Hikas from Charter School Development Center. Do you have anything to inform us, Mr. Keller?
No, ma'am. Rob Kramer was invited for this meeting, but he doesn't appear to be here.
So. Okay.
Good morning. So, we'll just be stuck in traffic. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you this morning about charter schools. I have worked with probably about half of you, and the other half I have not worked with, so please bear with me as I just kind of give you a brief summary of who I am. My name is Karin Hikas, for the record, and I'm with the Charter Schools Development Center, and we are a statewide charter school resource center that works with all stakeholders within the charter school arena, charter school developers, operators, district sponsors, partners, and we've been in Oregon for about 2 years on a full-scale basis. The organization's been around for 13 years, primarily based, founded in California, has done a lot of work in California and nationally and even some international work, but we've been in Oregon for about 2 years, and my background's public education, and I've been in Oregon doing that for many years. I do have a status report for you if you're more interested in kind of what we've done over the past 2 years. But we basically offer comprehensive services for folks ranging from we do offer membership, we help developers design their charter school proposal application, et cetera, set everything up. We work with schools either on behalf of schools or districts to evaluate charter schools. We do workshops, we have publications, all those sorts of things. And 2005 was the first legislative session that we were involved in. We worked on the charter school renewal law, which was House Bill 3174, and many of you helped us with that. So that's kind of my context. And I just want to talk with you a little bit about the state and national context for charter schools and some of the pending policy issues that are facing us here in Oregon related to charter schools. And tell me how long you want me to talk.
Oh, why don't you give us about 10, 15 minutes?
Perfect. Okay, so our law passed in 99, and we currently have 70 operating charter schools in Oregon. And we have between 7,000 and 8,000 students attending those 70 charter schools. So about 1.5% of our K-12 public student population. Nationally, 40 of our states and Washington, D.C. have charter school laws, and we have about 4,000 charter school students right now. Everyone's still scrambling because school just started, but right about 4,000 and serving slightly more than a million students. So nationally serving about 3% of the K-12 population. Just some basic information about the Oregon charter schools in terms of where they came from. 80% of them started as new schools. 20% of them did not. They converted either from existing alternative high schools or from district schools that were on the verge of having to shut down because of funding or, you know, redistricting and those sorts of things. Almost all of our schools, 69 of our schools, are sponsored by their local school district boards. And we have one school over in Ontario, Four Rivers Community School, that's sponsored by the State Board of Education. In terms of governance, 80% of our charters are operated by independent, nonprofit charter school boards, and 20% are operated either functionally or legally by the district board directly. We've had 15 charter schools who have closed. Most of those closures have been due to financial instability. And the self-reported successes of charter schools, top successes, are that they have satisfied.
Do you want questions as we go?
Would that be okay with you, Karin?
Sure.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does the closure compare nationwide? Is that, or, you know, ours, are we starting too many or are we not?
As far as percentage compared to opening, I think it's probably fairly low. compared to nationally.
Can you tell us that and give us that information later?
Sure. I can definitely find that out for you.
You can send that information to Mr. Keller.
Okay. Be happy to.
I'm Representative Bell.
On the governance structure, you were mm-hmm. talking about 69 of our charter schools are controlled by the district. In a normal district, if we had several elementaries, a couple of middle schools, and maybe a high school or two, the process works from the school site through the district office, and I'm looking at financial audit, performance audit, those sorts of things. Is there an established trap line for charter schools? If they're part of the district, does the Department of Ed have oversight directly, or does the oversight go through the district offices?
Are you talking about the majority that are sponsored by their local district?
If one were sponsored by the local district, yeah.
So they are considered, it's kind of interesting, and in some states, charter schools are considered completely independent from their school district. They're their own LEAs. They get their funding directly. And in some states, they are completely part of the district. In Oregon, we're kind of halfway in between. Where these charter schools are counted in the district attendance, you know, report cards, AYP data, etc. They get their funding from the local school district. So the district gets it from the state, and then they pass a percentage on to the charter school. In terms of all the reporting, you know, program reporting, fiscal reporting, audits, they all go directly to the district, but they also, copies of those get sent to the state. The state's primary role is administering and allocating the federal grant as far as the charter school piece. And they provide some technical assistance, but as far as their formal role, it's more related to the grant. So that oversight really does fall with the district.
Yeah, it seems to me that that's a provision in the charter, isn't it? That whatever the duration of the charter, that generally the charter presents themselves to the board for an overview, and then the charter is renewed in 3 years. So generally, it's a local issue, it would seem to me, and that's where I'm going with it.
Yes, thank you. You're right. Any more questions at this point? Do feel free to pipe in.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
The federal grants that you're talking about, the department administrating, are those the startup grants, or are there other kinds besides?
The startup grants. They're called, the formal name here is the Charter School Incentive Grant, which includes three stages, the planning or startup, and then the implementation and continued implementation. And when folks apply, they're applying for the full, all three stages, basically. And as long as they continue through the process and get an approved charter proposal, then have an executed contract and operate, they generally and spend the funding appropriately, they tend to continue to progress through that.
Can I have a follow-up, Matt? So the federal grants, how many years do they extend for?
Well, the whole grant has to be spent within a 3-year time period. The planning phase can be up to 18 months, but it can be as short as it takes for folks to get an approved proposal and a signed contract.
So there's a set beginning and ending to the planning phase?
Right, but it's more based on activities than on time.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
And then what happens after that?
After the whole grant?
No, after the planning phase is finished.
Okay, so the planning phase is about $50,000. So $25,000 until a charter group has their proposal approved by a district. And then another $25,000 until they have a signed contract with a sponsoring district. And then depending on the number of students, it's up to a maximum of $150,000 for the next stage, and same for the next stage. So maximum of $350,000.
And so the 150, if I might follow up, the $150,000 part of the grant is to actually get the school up and running. So is it for hiring teachers and furnishing the school and buying materials and all that?
Well, everything except hiring teachers. The grant funding is really for kind of the one-time startup costs. So no operational costs can be covered through that grant.
Okay.
So program development, curriculum development, establishing the policies, purchasing all the material and equipment. So it can't be used for salaries, and it can't be used for purchasing or leasing facilities. It can be used to renovate facilities to bring them up to code. But other than that, it can't be used for facilities.
So if you combine the planning part with the startup part, you get 3 years over the both of those two parts of the process before the federal funding goes away.
Right.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And part of the requirements generally from that one are that you attend the national charter school materials, or they encourage it strongly.
Yeah, not required. They're encouraged to attend the National Charter School Conferences, although the U.S. Department of Ed is no longer directly putting those conferences on, and so they used to offer supplemental funds, too, to the groups that received the grant funds, and I don't know if that will continue.
On this, and I don't want to be stuck on this governance piece, but is there a procedure in place so that if a charter school generates a complaint, either with performance or in any area, does the charter school law have a procedure as to where a complainant enters the system? And is there an organized protocol for handling concerns?
Representative Dahlem, the law does not address that specifically. So the charter schools that we work with, we encourage them to have grievance and complaint procedures adopted, policies adopted by their board. Not all charter schools necessarily do that. Typically, those things are delineated in the charter contract with the district, but not always. You know, again, it depends on who's working on that document.
May I ask another question?
Representative.
Again, on financing. So I think I have a pretty good understanding of the federal dollars. Can you talk to us about when the state school fund dollars kick into this process and how they become available to a charter school?
Certainly. The state dollars, the state school fund allocates, you know, a certain amount per student per year per district. So the dollars become available when the charter school actually has kids sitting in, you know, walking into the building. So when they begin to operate and serve students, and actually a little bit before that, because they're on the same cycle as all the other, you know, the districts. So I think they get their first payment in August, typically. So actually right before the kids come in. But based on projected enrollment, they will... The district actually claims the students as their students, unless they're special ed students. Then they remain residents of their residential district, and they're claimed by that district. But for regular education students, they are claimed on the district reports to the Department of Education. The district receives 100% of the ADM weight for that student, and there's a charter ADM weight for charter students. And students who are in K-8 receive 80% of that ADM weight. So charter schools receive 80% for their K-8 students and 95% for their 9-12 students. And they receive that every month from their district.
So what I heard you say was that the federal planning grants cover the kind of the process setup and the building and materials setup, but it doesn't cover the staff and the salaries of the staff. So if right. you're a startup charter school, what happens? Because you don't actually get funding until students are enrolled. How do you get past the staffing part of it?
In terms of hiring the staff early, you can use the funds for stipends, for professional development, for curriculum development, and a lot of charter schools, the teachers and the administrators actually design the curriculum and make sure it's aligned to state standards and those sorts of things. So some folks do come on prior to operation, and then the charter school grant funds can be used for consulting stipends, those sorts of things.
Thank you.
Representative Dahlem, then Representative Roblin.
I want to dig this out a little bit.
Okay.
Because schools are funded, and Representative Wisnett and I were talking this morning about how to more equitably disperse funds when a school has skyrocketing enrollment. There is a time when the charter school is funded by the district, and it's a repay process, isn't it? When the charter school starts up, those kids will not be counted in the enrollment, or they will be counted in the enrollment but not paid for until their attendance is established. So the district really, if they're a district-sponsored charter, the district is supporting that school until it gets up and running. And I believe the first payments come after the first year?
Right, you're right, because everything is kind of a year after the fact. for the students who are actually there. So you're right, Representative Dahl.
Would it be less of a hardship on districts and on charter schools if we took that sample enrollment, say, a semester earlier? Would that mitigate this float time for charters and districts? Would that be helpful?
I think that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the other thing I would say is that most of the charters also have done pre-enrollment. I mean, they, part of that
sure.
money and all the other kind of stuff, have they have parent meetings and they do a lot of other kind of stuff to make sure that the interest is there and the people are there. And they do a pre-enrollment thing. So they have a pretty good idea, and they can tell the, actually, oftentimes in the spring before, and show the district, here's who we have, here's who's coming,
yes.
here's who's signed up and filled out all the paperwork for us. So that, I mean, when part of that federal grant money is used oftentimes to help them get that in place so they can walk into the district office and say, here's the kids we expect to have on the first day. And districts generally, I think, have honored that and said, here's your money up.
You're absolutely right. A lot of folks use the planning grant funds to market, do outreach. And as you know, charter schools are open admission schools. And so grade and age are the only criteria that a charter school can use for admission. They usually begin the enrollment and outreach process way in advance of the school opening, at least 6 months, if not even further ahead. And so sometimes charter contracts actually have a number in them saying you can only, you know, your cap is 200 students, for instance, and so they know they only have room for 200 students, and so once they reach 200, you know, so the district's committing essentially to funding 200 and no more. But you're absolutely right. Before summer, usually there's a list of students who are enrolled for the next year.
Follow-up. And that also, initially, I think that's percentage of the kids that are in it have to be from the local district that's sponsoring it, and another percentage can be outside of that?
It's actually not in the law anymore. It did sunset several years ago. There was a concern, you know, initially when the law first passed about, you know, so charter schools drawing large numbers of students from outside the district, and so there was an 80-20% provision put in, and that actually has sunset, and prior to the sunset, there weren't any issues with that. I think the maximum number percentage of students from outside the district for any charter was 10%. So now the way the law reads is that students within the district that sponsor the charter must be given priority, and then if there is room, students who live outside the district can enroll.
Representative Collins. There's one who you talked about capping enrollment in any charter school enterprise. The cap on enrollment is 90 or most of the time a financial consideration, not a capacity consideration, and it's done so that the local district might have some notion of what their financial obligation is. Is that correct?
Well, it really varies. I mean, certainly that's the case in some situations. In some situations, charter schools want to remain small, and so they want a cap. And you're absolutely right. Some districts want the cap for financial, so they know what the budget impact is on their district for that year.
I want to go to the other end of the formula then. If a charter school, and we had some 15 of them closed down because of lack of money, if the percentages hold, those districts then that have sponsored a charter school have a lump sum without an obligation for almost a year. When the charter school closes down, the attendance is taken, and they get the payments a year later. So there is a tail where sponsoring schools do realize a financial benefit with no obligation. Would that happen in some cases?
I don't know if I understand the intricacies of school finance enough to answer that question.
Representative Roblin, you want to weigh in?
Well, my guess on that one would be that the sponsoring district, not the school.
The sponsoring district, yes. Let me clear that up. The district would have a tail payment with no obligation to spend it on the chart.
Right, but that would all balance out in the end based on real enrollment.
So if we could move that response time back a semester, that would be probably helpful for everybody.
Most of the charter schools that have closed down have had notice. I mean, we had one charter school that closed down because of health and safety reasons. All the others were for financial reasons, not necessarily because they didn't have enough money. We had schools that didn't pay PERS. We had schools for, you know, a variety of financial instability or financial mismanagement. But Yeah, I think that would be helpful.
Please proceed.
Okay. One of the main questions that folks ask throughout the country is, how successful are charter schools? What is their achievement like? What's their student achievement like? What's their performance like as organizations? And it's really a hard question to answer. And there are dueling studies, you know, that have been done all over the country from a variety of groups who either have biases or don't have biases. So just broadly speaking, and I'm not, you know, with ODE, and ODE has a lot more detail, but my understanding from this past year, which is consistent with previous years, in terms of Oregon, the charter schools serving K-8 students are really on par with some of the best, you know, public schools in the state in terms of student achievement, using the state assessments as the measuring rod. The 9-12 students in charter schools are struggling, just like our 9-12 students are in our other public schools. And so that's kind of the state of things, just again using that state assessment as the measuring tool. Nationally, there's again a lot of research. I do have some concepts in my documentation for you and some reports that I recommend that you might want to take a look at. The whole school, you know, evaluating a whole school is something that's relatively new historically, and of course No Child Left Behind has really pushed that to the forefront and made it a very urgent matter. Everyone wants to know, how is the whole school performing? And in order to really measure charter schools' achievement, there are a lot of kind of awkward comparisons that have to be made, because really the question is, how well are these students achieving in this charter school versus how well would they have achieved had they stayed in the school they were in before they went to the charter school? And because a person can't be in two places at the same time, it's really hard to make that comparison. And so there's a lot of, you know, analysis that's done, again, by a variety of folks who either have biases or don't, and there's a lot of conflicting studies. The Center for Reinventing Public Education out of the University of Washington is a group that is really known for their credible research. They're very inclusive and pretty objective, nonpartisan. And they, last year, analyzed all of the charter school studies that had been done across the nation. And essentially, most of them draw either positive or neutral conclusions about charter school performance. And the minority of those studies were, you know, had negative findings. So I do encourage you to read some of the Center for Reinventing Public Ed's reports. Some of the pending charter school policy issues here in Oregon, you've already touched on some through the conversation about the grant. And they're the same policy issues that were wrestled with in the 90s here in Oregon, and they're the same policy issues that have been wrestled with in other states with charter laws. And number one is the operational funding for charter schools. You know, there are a lot of folks questioning the adequacy of the funding for public school students, period, in Oregon. And so charter schools receive less than the traditional schools. And unfortunately, some of the early charter school proponents like to say that, you know, charters could do more with less. That actually has not proven to be the case nationally. And so it's an issue.
Madam Chair?
Representative Yarkey.
I just want to clarify that comment. When you say less, you're talking about the lower percentage they get through the ADM.
The lower
percentage is not, but that does not, your comment does not include the 3 years of additional federal funding that charter schools have access to. Is that right?
Correct. Sure, they get the startup funding, but when that money is gone, that's when most of them face their financial struggles. So the financial planning needs to start, the long-term financial planning needs to start before the beginning and take into account the fact that that money will go away, and then how will they remain solvent? And again, there is a special charter school rate that is not necessarily the same within each district as the district ADM weight. So the starting point isn't necessarily the same.
Representative Gelzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the allocation to the charter schools for the percentage that's held back by the school district, is it the school district's obligation to provide that overarching administrative support, student services, and special education out of that piece that's held back?
That's a really good question. And The law does not say that the school district is obligated or not obligated to provide anything for the percentage that they retain. My understanding is that the rationale for setting it up that way when the law passed was that the district would provide some services. In terms of practice, that really varies across the state. Some districts provide so much service that it surpasses the value of, you know, that 5% they're retaining, and some districts don't provide any services. And so it really varies from charter school to charter school and the arrangement that they have with the districts.
For special education or 504 English language learner students, if there is a complaint of services not being delivered, who holds the responsibility for that? Is that the school district, or is that the is it the hosting school district, or is it the charter school?
It is, and special education is a fairly separate issue within charter schools. The district where the student resides retains responsibility to comply with IDEA and to provide those special education services, and they keep any extra dollars that they receive to provide those services.
So one more follow-up. So in the percentage that the charter schools get, they do not have an obligation to provide special education services with the dollars that they have. They only provide services to regular education students, and the school district retains the responsibility for those special ed students, but provides that in that location of the charter school.
The district retains responsibility in funding. I would not say that charter schools do not provide special education services.
But they're paid for. The cost of them.
If they're pull-out services, if the district sends specialists to the charter school, then the district funds those. But most of the special ed students are in the regular ed classrooms, and the teachers are modifying and making accommodations for those kids.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So one option for us as we're wrestling with, you know, are we going to increase the funding for all K-12 students, is to increase the funding for K-8 students up to 95% where the high school students are. Most of our charter schools across the state are serving K-8 students, and getting 80% of the ADM weight is really challenging for them. And, you know, talking with superintendents, you know, they'll say that the it costs more money to educate high school students, which I believe is true. However, if you're a charter school serving K-8, you don't have the flexibility to allocate more to high school and less to elementary. You just get less to begin with. And that's a challenge. So that's one possibility. And I do just want to clarify here, our organization is still in the process of formalizing our legislative agenda, so I'm not necessarily posing any of this as, you know, this is our recommendation, just some options. So another big issue is charter sponsoring agencies. Right now, as we talked about, the district is really the only entity that is authorized to sponsor charter schools, except through appeals the State Board of Education can. And this is something that we would like to see changed. Because we don't want to see a charter school and a school district be forced into a contractual relationship with each other. If the district doesn't want to sponsor a charter school because it doesn't fit with their mission, because they're focused on other issues, there are a variety of reasons why they might not want to do that. But there may be a very valid, quality, innovative charter school that meets a need in that community, and we would like to see that charter school be able to exist and not have a forced relationship. And so, you know, across the country, folks have all sorts of different authorizers, and I don't know that a menu or a laundry list of, you know, 5 or 6 different authorizers would make sense in Oregon, but one option that we are exploring is using universities with teacher training programs as sponsors for charter schools. And so that's an issue that that I wanted to raise today. Facilities funding, separate from the ADM weight. Do you have a question?
Just to explore the issue around who authorizes the charter schools, what are, in other areas of the country besides universities, what are other area or other entities that are permitted to authorize?
In some states, large nonprofits, you know, with a certain annual budget, certain capacity, certain length of operation, are allowed to authorize charter schools. In some states, community colleges, some states, counties, or a kind of our ESD equivalent, you know, a county layer. I think we have one city, you know, mayor that authorizes charter schools.
May I ask a follow-up? So in those kinds of situations where how are the issues of fiscal and operational oversight addressed in that there's taxpayers' dollars involved in this?
I think that's a great question, and I don't have all that. I don't have the full answer on that today. I have been researching that, and I think it really varies from state to state. And whether it's legislated or not, in some states, yes, and other states, it's just kind of left up to the operational relationship between each charter and its authorizer.
I would think that that would be quite a large part of the discussion around the proposal to broaden out the authorizers.
It definitely is, and it's something that a lot of stakeholders are talking about in terms of, okay, so if universities with teacher training programs can sponsor charter schools, what does that look like? What's the role then of the Department of Education in that? Will the universities expect the Department of Education to, you know, there are a lot of implications, I think, and some clarification that should be in whatever policy we do adopt, I would think, in order to minimize confusion.
I see in your presentation, Karen, that you've got a list of the policy considerations.
I do.
And I would like to move you to, as we kind of wrap up, and I know I don't want to short you on what you'd like to talk to us about, but like to address the Oregon School Board Association recommendations that kind of expanded some criteria. Would you like to comment on that for us?
Sure. This is on page 5. This is kind of after some of the pending policy issues and some other possible legislative revisions to the law. The Oregon School Boards Association recently put together a fairly lengthy set of policies that they have put on their website and are recommending to charter to districts to adopt. And I have met with several folks at OSBA and really tried to delve into the rationale for this, where this really came from, the implications for this, and I'm still pretty puzzled about where this did come from, and I'm concerned because, you know, our charter law requires that charter proposals include 25 elements, and the OSBA template policy requires 100 elements, so 75 more than the law requires. And the law already says that in addition to the 25, districts may require any other additional information they deem necessary. My understanding is that some folks have pushed back on that and have said, we don't have to give this to you because the law doesn't say we do. And so my understanding is part of where these policies have come from, they're a little reactionary to a few isolated incidents around the state, which also concerns me. Developing something with this level of impact in reaction to a few isolated incidents. Many of the proposed elements in these policies are things that certainly need to be in place when the schools begin operating, but I don't think they need to be in place a year ahead of time or 2 years ahead of time. A lot of districts' deadlines are a year and a half before a school starts to open, and I think to expect charter schools to have all of their textbooks with copyright dates identified for every class is a little unreasonable. Those are some of the things that are in there. And having policies on all aspects of their school, you know, a year, year and a half ahead of time, back to that grant, I think there's only one charter school that's opened that has not utilized the federal grant. And again, they only have access to $25,000 to write this proposal. So policy design is very expensive, very time-consuming, and being done that far ahead of time outside of the context of, hey, we're almost ready to open, doesn't make a lot of sense to us. So we're pretty concerned about these policies because they are really, and I don't know how they put them together. It almost looks to me like they scoured the country and found every law and just put it all in there. And I know that's kind of sarcastic, but they don't make a lot of sense to us. And so I don't know exactly what can be done except to maybe put something in legislation that says districts, mm-hmm. you know, can require, emphasize that they can already ask for additional information. And also say that district policies need to match the legislative intent of this law, which is that the law is to be interpreted liberally in order to start new schools and provide choice for kids. So that's that piece.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. And this one kind of goes back to what Senator Morgan was talking about. With regard to oversight and the monies that they get, do they have to send an audit to the State Department of how their money is spent each year, like districts do? Or is it combined in the district audit?
No, they have to send their own audit. Each charter school has a municipal audit every year, and that gets sent to the district and to the Department of Education / State Board of Education.
Representative Baldwin.
Is it a provision in most charters that the charter must provide an outside audit and give that to the local board? That's pretty standard.
Absolutely.
Boilerplate, isn't it?
Because it's required by law.
Yeah.
So it is in most. It is in every charter I've seen. And a lot of the charters have timelines. They're done in the late summer, early fall.
So what happens is our charter is audited by an outside agency that's submitted to the school board. They're audited with a passing glance by the school board when they have their books audited. And then ODE gets a look at both of those audits, is the way it really works, isn't it?
Right.
So they have oversight twice when most schools have once. And that'd be a fair statement?
I don't know. It depends on the operational and financial relationship with the district as to whether the charter school is included in the district's audit. But otherwise, yes, I think that's accurate.
Representative Roblin.
And that goes back to the idea of having other sponsoring agencies, the issue of, because my understanding is the research we did when we were starting some of ours, they fail because of financial problems and because they don't use the money appropriately, and so the district gets upset. And do we find that more in those that are not directly tied to a school district outside nationally, or is it just that's just the number one reason that most of them don't make it is financial issues?
The number one challenge is facilities, which, of course, is linked to finances.
Yeah.
It's really, that is the number one challenge for every state, self-reported and objectively researched. There really aren't very many states at all that have adequately provided for facilities for charter schools. So that's at the top of the financial struggles, too. And I don't know if there is any variance between those sponsored by local districts and those sponsored by others. I'd be happy to research that for you, though.
Okay. I'm good to know.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. I noticed going through trying to read, too, that you said that's the number one facility. So, but that's not on your legislative agenda. I mean, to me, that looks like that'd be an easy bill to pass, and no one would object to it. They, you know, try to help these people find facilities. I was in Baker City last week at the new Armory there in Baker City, and the community college was using their classrooms for community college activities. And we need to do more and more of that in this state. That building is sitting empty. There may be options to use it. I'm still upset that last year we toured the prison, the Coffee Creek facility. They had a complete set of woodworking equipment in there that was in boxes, and I know that we have schools. I would love to have a professional technical program for woodworking and things. So we don't do a good job of that in this state. I don't know who's responsible. It's DAS or who would be sure that we're getting maximum utilization out of facilities that we're taxpayers are paying for. So to me, your statement on the bottom of page 3 looks like it'd be easy to do a bill to require state agencies and state school districts to try to help you lease buildings or negotiate.
Mm-hmm. Noted. Representative Morgan.
Just a comment, if I might, Madam Chair. I have in my legislative district actually two school districts, and Representative Krieger has one in his district, public school districts that have turned their middle schools and high schools into charter schools. Some have done the whole thing. And these are small rural school districts that have experienced declining enrollment over the last 20 years. And they also are districts where the community is very much involved in the and interested in what goes on in the K-12 system in the communities. And the districts, having embraced turning their middle schools and high schools into charter schools, I think it's been, in one case, the jury's still out. And the other case is it is going very well from the perspective of the community being involved and the children being well educated and being able to actually offer a broader range of electives and education opportunities than they were able to before they were chartered. The interesting thing that we're all looking at right now is that they are all in the final stages of using the federal grants. So they're in either the second or third year of being able to use that as a source of funding. And there's a great deal of interest in whether or not they're going to continue to be successful as that funding source isn't available to them anymore. But again, these are districts that are intrinsically involved in these schools and totally supportive of them. And this was a program that kept them from having to close their middle schools and high schools. It kept those programs alive in those communities.
Thank you. Representative Roland.
And I guess I just wanted to make a comment on that, because I agree that there's a number of have done that, and it in helped in our area in getting some stuff. And it was really because of the federal money, because there wasn't enough money in the system to keep it going, and they would have otherwise had to close. And there's a couple others in those same areas that are in the same place that are looking at how do we find funding just to keep alive because of declining enrollment. And the extra money from the federal government gives them that little push to stay there for a couple more years. But we have a real issue if we don't look at funding for public education in general, not charter school movement. So, I agree.
Well, and just, again, if you would indulge me, I would also make the point that part of the problem that we have in funding schools, particularly in the rural areas, is that we don't have a large manufacturing base anymore. Our natural resource industries have, for a variety of reasons, had the soup knocked out for them, and so the average wages in the rural areas of the state are substantially lower than the I-5 corridor of the Willamette Valley. And one of the things we could also do to help augment the funding for schools is to get people back to work in the woods and in the commercial fishing industry and in the ag industry.
Thank you.
I agree with that.
Know you agree. Thank you very much for
your
information and being a resource for some of the questions that can help inform our thinking. And I know that we are all looking forward to moving forward with seeing recommendations that will come from your entity as well as the other that we may yet hear from today.
Well, and many of these recommendations are also on the Chalkboard Projects Action Plan, and we've been working with them on that and talking about what to move forward with this year versus next session and that sort of thing. I do want to draw your attention to the fact that we are having a Charter Schools Conference next week, Friday and Saturday, Oregon's first statewide for all stakeholders. Would love to see you there. You won't have to pay any registration fees, so just come. Thank you so much
Thank
for your
you
time.
Thank you very much.
Well,
we do have an adjustment in our schedule. I don't see Rob Kramer here, and that's unfortunate. Due to the absence of the speaker, we are going to be moving the stable funding proposal discussion to another one of our meetings, and so that will just be moving forward. So then, with that, we will jump to our...
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Woodnett.
She pays me to do this.
No, she does not. Does not.
And why, Leah?
I'd kindly request on my behalf and behalf of the committee that we have their plans beforehand so we can review them. If you make that
very
request.
Well noted. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
I didn't hear what he said.
That we have the documentation that we'll be discussing or the information that will be presented in advance so that we will have an opportunity to go through it.
I find that very helpful.
It is helpful.
Yeah,
it's
possible to do
so
that.
We will do that when we schedule and get that on the next schedule. Thank you very much. So with us today, we're going to have a discussion about the Head Start proposals that are percolating and moving forward. We have with us today Dick Alexander, who is chair of Ready for School, and Dr. David Mandel, is that Children's Institute? Very well. If you'd like to come forward.
Is this really the last item on our agenda?
It
is.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for giving us an opportunity to come down today and talk to you a little bit about what, in our opinion, is one of the cornerstones of improving the overall education system in the state of Oregon, and one that's probably hasn't had the appropriate amount of attention that it deserves. And hopefully after we share our comments with you, you'll determine whether that's correct or not. Hey, my name is Dick Alexander. I'm the chair of the statewide Ready for School campaign. A little bit of background so that you know who I am. I came to Oregon in 1965 to start a company called Viking Industries and was its CEO for 33 years and sold it a few years ago. And I've been involved in civic affairs for a long time and enjoyed it. I part of my educational exposure, I chaired the board at OES for several years. I served on it for about 8 years, and I'm presently vice chair of the board of Merrillhurst University. And I think I share that with you mainly so that you'll see that I come from a broader education perspective than just Head Start, and I see Head Start's importance from that perspective in part. But also, what really brought me to this issue, this would be a strange path maybe, but I also served on the Citizens Crime Commission for 14 years, and I was chairing it when we had a retreat several years ago, and we had taken a position pretty much that there has to be progressive sanctions and more or less the broken window theory, and more police officers on the streets and have an adequate number of cells to cause a person to know if they break the law, there's a place for them to go that they won't like. And we'd stuck pretty much with that. And we had a retreat one August several years ago, and with Measure 11, the impact of several things that had taken place, we said, what's causing us to advocate for locking up so many kids? That when you look at the age group that's going down to Salem and the other penal institutions, they're younger and younger, and we just keep doing that. Why do we keep doing it? And the expression we used was, how do we turn off the bubble machine? Because no matter what we do, you can't build enough cells to build your way out of it. Most people agreed with that. And so we decided to do some research and find the answer, and we put together a committee that was chaired by Jim Jedlow and Fred Stickel, we did about 10 months of research on what causes this. And we brought people in from the Brookings Institute and Rand Corporation. We had Professor Hillwalker, known to many of you probably from the University of Oregon, that gave us a great deal of good counsel and pointed us in the right directions. We listened to Dr. Del Elliott, who was considered one of the national authorities on the reasons for juvenile violence, as is Hillwalker. And we turned out a kids report, and it really woke us all up to the importance of early intervention with these kids. That if you try to sort it out later on, very expensive and with very limited outcomes. And I think they educated us, at least on the committee, that there's primary, secondary, and tertiary intervention with young people that are going wrong in their lives. And primary intervention is at the very early age where you can change the trajectory of behavior without any permanent damage to the young person. Secondary, you can back it up and probably correct it pretty well, but it costs a lot more money. And in tertiary, you probably will spend a great deal of money and probably have limited outcomes when you get to that point, which is the later teen years when you're trying to correct it. And that was supported in the research. And anyway, so we turned out our kids report, and it became kind of the genesis document for Dan Salzman's CHIPS deal in Portland, investment fund for children. And it was very helpful, I think, when which I've referred back to as the bill with no sponsor, but it was the bill that went before your body some years ago that Governor Kitzhaber was putting forth along with Gene Durkler, and there was kind of a mixed message about who was really behind it. But it was a bill to intervene in some of these issues and had some success, and then it was heard in special session. But anyway, that is just by way of quick background so that I come to the issue. I now approach you as chair of the
the statewide Ready for School campaign. And it's really just a continuation of this effort that was born of this understanding we developed about the importance of it some years ago. And I want to suggest to you, and this may influence you negatively about me and think I'm bringing a little bit of sensational issue to you, but I really think Oregon, and this view is shared with some others, but it's kind of at a crossroads right now. When you look at the shifting demographics in the state, the aging of the population, which is going to continue to be more significant as we go forward. You look at, Riffin and Morgan referred to the reduction in outlying areas' incomes when we lost our lumber mills and our natural resource industry. I think the average income has plunged about $8,000 a year, something like that, and I think it's pretty close. These are some things that are really hitting the state very hard. And then we have the in-migration of new citizens that have to be assimilated into our culture and our society in a way that lets them be productive going forward. I think we are threatened by a situation where we have flat to declining per capita inflation-adjusted incomes across the state, coupled with a increasing demand for social services on a per capita basis because of those same demographic shifts. And where those lines begin to intersect, wherever it is, 5 years, 10 years, there is in that compression is the quality of life in this state. All right, now I'm going to talk to you about Head Start. Pardon me for that, but because I think it's one of the silver bullets, if there is one, that can change that. In this state, we've done a pretty good job of trying to get more kids covered in pre-K, Head Start, Oregon pre-K Head Start. There are about 3,000 plus children that aren't covered on a regular basis, building forward and back. Best way to characterize it, and I know that Representative Dallin has heard me say this before, so bear with me. You want another committee that I've appeared before. But let's take a case of one of these kids. These children that I'm going to talk to you about, the children who are eligible for Head Start funding, come from homes below the poverty line. They could be homes where there's a mother working hard to living alone, working two jobs, and trying to make a living to get her kid fed. Doesn't have a lot of time to read to the child. They could be homes where there's a single parent who's not making a real effort to support their child. There could be a home where one of the parents is incarcerated. There could be a home that's had children's service referral to the home. There could be a home where there's abuse in the home. It could be a home where there are very few books, and reading is not a primary thing that takes place in the home. There could be a home where there's no car or no telephone. These are troubled people in the state of Oregon. These are the children that live in those homes. Now, when those children, and I could use an example, a few weeks ago, school started, and kids went back to school. There was about something over 3,000 kids that didn't have the benefit of Head Start last year that started to school along with their peers. Now, their peers, in large percentage, have had the benefit of some type of pre-kindergarten experience. A large, overwhelming percentage of kids in Oregon do have that benefit. Many others have a wonderful home environment where reading is done regularly, daily, and they're exposed to good backgrounds. Well, the kids that started, the kids from this group that I just mentioned that started with them, will enjoy it. It'll be different. There'll be a hot lunch. There'll be toys on the playground that they'll play on. And they'll have new friends that they haven't had in their environment. And they'll feel good about it for a year or two. Things will go along reasonably well. About the third year that they're in school, they'll begin to realize that they aren't doing as well as their peers. They'll begin to realize that they are being referred and related to somewhat differently by the teachers. And they'll realize that their peers, who they've enjoyed playing with, no longer relate to them exactly the same way they used to. And they'll begin to realize that they're failing. A child that's not reading at third grade level at the end of third grade is likely not be reading at ninth grade level at the end of the ninth grade. That's been demonstrated repeatedly in the research. It's very clear. I submit that when these children get into the fourth and fifth grade, where you're beginning to, the thing is you learn to read after the third grade, you read to learn after the third grade, fourth and fifth grade. When they get into fourth and fifth grade, they really realize they're beginning, they're failing, and they'll begin to reject school administrative measures of standards, how they're doing, and they just kind of mentally drop out of school. That's a terrible thing that they do. They say, I'm here, I have to come, but I'm not engaged. Now, in this period of time, the teacher is going to spend a disproportionate amount of time trying to keep them involved and move them along. But they mentally drop out in the 4th, 5th, 6th grade. They get big enough to walk out in the 9th, 10th, 11th grade. And in that period of time, and we know this is happening because a lot of you sit on those committees. I know Representative Morgan does. We spend an enormous amount of money trying to keep these kids in school through special programs and with limited success, very limited outcomes. So it's just a kind of a built-in failure mechanism. I'm going to quote one piece of research, and I'm going to let Dr. Mandel do the research piece of the Children's Institute because he does it very well. But one I have to share with you that came out fairly recently, Jim Heckman, who is an economist, University of Chicago, Nobel laureate, very highly regarded in his research. You're talking about high school, K-12. His research indicates that the children that I just referred to and the environment I referred to, which are our Head Start kids in Oregon, they have a 29% probability of graduating from high school. 29%. That's where they are. Now, given that they have a 29% chance of graduating, and other groups around the state, and maybe your group, is sitting and reviewing data that suggests that we raise the standards. In third grade reading, we raise the standard of measurement, that we raise the graduation requirements in high school. And what we're doing is moving away from this population farther and farther. Now, what happens to these kids? They're more likely, they'll drop out of school. They're more likely to be unemployed. Many of them, because of lifestyle habits they develop, will be unemployable. They're more likely to be incarcerated. Go over here and check the ages and the educational background of the kids in prison, or the women in prison. They're more likely to be dependent upon social services as they go through life and as they become adults. And this is an interesting part to me. We need to pay a lot of attention to the type of adults these kids become, because that's where the cost really hits. It's in their adult years. They're more likely, again, to be incarcerated up to a certain age. And our research at the Children's Institute Crime Commission showed that at some point they quit breaking the law. They get too old, I guess, to run. But they're more likely to be dependent on social service systems. They're more likely to develop lifestyle-induced medical problems, which we pay for. And they go through life constantly supported by the social safety nets that we provide. They don't contribute to the tax base. They're a taker of it. And then they die. And it doesn't end when they die. Because if they had children during those years, the probability of those children following the same pattern is very, very high. So the thing that we ask you to do is to give serious thought to putting a lot of emphasis on getting the rest of these children that aren't in Head Start into the program. It is one of the silver bullets, and it has to be taken into consideration, I think, with equal standing with anything else in the education continuum. And if we don't, we'll continue to feed into the system problems that we and you have to look at it from two perspectives. I think we do. I suggest you do. You don't have to do anything. But is it the right thing to do for these children? And everyone knows that. To give them an opportunity, to give them a chance. Because they don't have a chance. The statistics prove it. The research proves it. I mean, if you want to say, oh, maybe some will make it, but the overwhelming majority won't make it through high school. If you want to do that, it's the right thing to do for the kids. But it is absolutely the right thing to do for the state of Oregon. Because if we don't do it, we end up paying for it forever. I had one lady ask me, and this happened. She said, why should I be concerned, Dick, if I live in a gated community? And I said, you don't necessarily need to be concerned if you live in a gated community, but you probably should consider getting a stronger gate because it's not going to get any better as we go forward. But that's a little bit of the story and what I think is happening. And I think the most important piece of corrective action that we can take in the area of education, and I support it. I just told you, I've been involved in K-12 and higher ed. But I think when you look at it from that perspective, we need to correct this problem at this point, or you can't correct K-12. How can you continue to feed into the system thousands of students a year that are totally unprepared to work at that level and expect the system to function efficiently? You can't. You're looking at classroom disruption. You're looking at disproportionate time, the requirement of teachers' time. You're looking at the change in the classroom dynamic that's not positive for the students that aren't prepared. There are just a number of reasons you should look at. But anyway, I'm going to at close, let Dr. Mandel share some of the research with you quickly, and then we'll have what we want to do is save a few minutes for a young woman who is a parent to come up and talk to you. Okay.
I think just by virtue of our pattern set earlier, we'll probably be extending our conversation, so don't feel rushed. So
okay.
Representative Dahlin, did you have a question?
I do have a few questions here because we have an excellent opportunity now. And we have talked before at the Head Start Task Force in the interim. And one of the things that the Head Start Task Force is going to recommend is that we fully fund Head Start. Pennies on the dollar. But we had a terrible time finding some research because of ethics problems, because of who we keep track of, that showed how Head Start students performed as opposed to those that did not participate. So right between these two pieces of testimony, I would say we have a couple of things that have to happen. Head Start has to be fully funded. But we will now have a group that we can trace or follow. It won't be right away, but we can follow for 10 or 12 or 14 years, mm-hmm. and we will be able to say that Head Start did reduce our dropout rate. Mm-hmm. Head Start did make us less susceptible to social services. So I think perhaps what we want to look at is a vehicle. First, a lot of things have to happen, but those that sit in these chairs 12 years, 14 years from now, ought to be able to have that information. We don't have it right now. And I think we ask, there's nobody that can dig that out. And I'm looking very much forward to that research. And I guess that's a comment, not a question.
Yes, it would be a comment. Thank you.
Kind of an editorial, wouldn't it be? You know?
No, that's a good, appropriate comment. Can I respond to it briefly? And Dr. Mandel can speak with this in more detail, but the gold standard study on the benefits of Head Start is the preschool model out of Ypsilanti, Michigan, where they took a group of children from the inner city and put them into a Head Start equivalent type program, a quality Head Start program. It was a good program. They took another group, it was a control group, and identified them but did not put them into the program. They've now tracked those children for about 40 years.
I'm sorry, what was the study?
40, pardon?
What was the...
Perry Preschool, and I'll let David give you the details. He has them. But this is an overview. And the children who had the benefit of the pre-K program, the Head Start equivalent program, have performed better in lifetime outcomes in every way that they measured than the control group did. And it is considered kind of the gold standard. Anecdotally, in Oregon, I met a lady at an event the other evening that's a principal of an elementary school, and she said that any first grade teacher or kindergarten teacher can tell you which children have been in pre-K and which haven't. They can tell the difference. But there is some standard, Representative Dallin, that you can look at. But we totally agree that one of the components, and I think it's true all through the education continuum, that we put in place very objective measurements going forward of what the outcomes are, and we need to get some of the universities or someone involved in doing that.
Representative Barker has a
question. Thank you. I had a question. I remember reading a story. There was a man, I think it was maybe Gresham High, or up towards Mount Hood somewhere, and he was Mexican. He dealt with the Mexican families in there. He was saying one of the problems was a lot of the mothers had second grade education, and education just wasn't in the. I mean, they didn't see that as something very valuable because they want the kids to get a job before too long. And so, how do you overcome that? How do you get those kids, those mothers, to let their kids come into Head Start to get them going?
The national organization which is looking at expanding access to preschool across the country actually just commissioned a survey of Latino community and actually found, I don't have the exact numbers and I can get the survey to you, but they found very, very strong support in the Latino community for wanting to get their children into high-quality pre-K programs, and they actually found that the biggest barrier for those families was not the interest, but was the cost. So I think there's actually some real evidence out there that this community, and in fact, if I remember, some of the numbers for interest in getting the kids into pre-K programs was actually higher than even some of the other comparison groups. So there is some evidence out there suggesting that these families really do are interested in this kind of program.
And Dr. Mandel, I will need you to give us your name for the
My apologies. David Mandel, Research Director of the Children's Institute.
Thank you.
And follow-up, and not just, I mean, that was just the one example, but also other families that just don't value education. I mean, you're talking about, I mean, I'm a retired policeman, so I saw the families as the dad got out of prison, older brother, the, you know, everybody just kind of, everybody's headed to Salem before too long with just no interest. And so I'm hoping, I mean, these things are encouraging to hear what you're saying, but I hope we can reach those families that have traditionally not really, you know, they expected their kid maybe even to get out of high school and get a good job, and we know those are fading fast as the mills aren't open anymore, and you know, even in like Detroit, you can't go to work down in General Mills any or General Motors anymore, and so on.
This is sort of a partial answer to your question. I mean, one of the things that we do know is that the more involved parents are in children's education, the better children do. We also know that the earlier you get them involved, the more likely they are to be involved later on. And we also know that parents are often, it's often easier to get parents engaged at the earliest stages of education later on. I think partially because parents feel more comfortable at that age, you know, being able to evaluate the education, but be a participant in it than when it gets up to high school algebra, for instance. So I think, you know, one of the side benefits of these kinds of programs is that it's also a really important conduit for getting parents involved in their children's education early. And if you do that, it's easier to keep them involved through the entire educational process.
Thank you.
Can I follow up on that? I remember sitting on the couches at Head Start meetings with parents. Is it mandatory when a parent comes in and signs up for Head Start, is it mandatory that they participate? Because it seems like most of them were involved in that activity. Is that a mandatory or is that a...
It's greatly encouraged. Yeah. I mean, the program is set up to involve parents in it. And home visits are a mandatory part of the program. So there's also an outreach where there are sort of visits to the home.
So the parent isn't mandated to attend, but the school is mandated to go find the parent.
Right, right. And in fact, it is mandated, and this is federal rules, that over 50% of the policy council, which has a real role in making decisions about the program, must be currently enrolled Head Start parents. So there's a real effort to make the parents an active participant in the program.
Is it incumbent upon, pardon me, follow up, Madam Chair?
Okay.
Do the Head Start programs keep track then so that they can demonstrate parent involvement some way?
There are probably parts of the it's called the PIR, their annual sort of assessment of the data that might be able to track that. I mean, I know the home visits have to be part of it, the policy councils have to be part of it. So I'm not sure what would be the sort of clearest tracking mechanism, but it is clearly a part of the mission and the orientation of the program.
And the genesis of all of this is because you know that parental involvement improves student performance.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We strongly favor that. In fact, the Ready for School campaign, the funding Head Start is a stake in the ground. But we need to do other things in our state to get our children really prepared, including some at the high school level, some parent training for young people so that they understand the responsibility of parenthood. Understand if they're going to have babies, this is what they should do to protect them and make sure that they come into the world right and grow up correctly. But that's another subject for another day.
Isn't that part of when I said in the parent meeting? Isn't that part of what Head Start does? Is teach parents how to get their child engaged in the school system, how to move there? That's part of the program, isn't it?
I think that probably in a number of programs that there's elements of that, and I think Head Start probably does a better job than some others of getting the parent aware of the importance of doing certain things with their child. And real quick, at OES, we had a program where we worked with Vos Middle School in Beaverton, and it was largely Hispanic. And our students would go over and work with those kids and interface with them in an instructional way, and the computer science and some other things. And when it first began, and we would have parents' night for the parents of these children to come to school, very few would show up. Later, more showed up. Later, quite a few more showed up. And before it was over, the parents were involved and talking and involved in the program and what their child was doing. But you saw it grow. And I think, Representative Barker, that goes back to your concern. It's there. It just needs the right start. And Head Start is the right start to encourage that, particularly with that population.
We derailed you, Dr. Nagel. Did you have a question, Representative Morgan?
Well, I would like to just hold my questions until after Dr. Mandel does his part of the presentation, if that's possible.
Thank you.
And I actually feel like much of what I was planning on saying has already been said, but my goal today is I want to do two things. Just tell you a little bit about the Children's Institute, since we're a relatively new organization and not all of you may be familiar with us. But then also focus mostly on the research about the benefits of high-quality early education. And as Dr. Alexander already mentioned, there's now been a number of studies that have tracked children in programs like Head Start, some for 15 years, some for 20 years. The high school Perry School that Mr. Alexander mentioned earlier has now tracked children up to the age of 40. And you know, there's a tremendous evidence now of the lifetime benefits of more stable families, more involvement with their children as adults, higher incomes, less criminal involvement, less drug abuse. What I want to mostly focus on today, instead of those absolutely wonderful benefits, and you know, our goal with education is always to set people on the right course for a lifetime, so I don't want to de-emphasize those benefits, but today I really want to talk about the research in relationship to educational system and educational reform, and why I really think it's incumbent on us to think about the OPK piece as part of that educational reform. The Children's Institute was formed about 3 years ago by business leaders and philanthropists who wanted to know what works to improve the lives of kids. And you know, since so many of the founders were members of the business community, they wanted to do the right thing, but they also wanted to do it in an efficient, cost-effective, meaningful way. And that was our initial charge. And when we began by scouring the research to national experts. We interviewed Oregon experts, and we reviewed study after study. And all our research pointed to one thing, the importance of high-quality early interventions, particularly early education, for at-risk children. And when you know that 90% of brain development happens before the age of 6, it's clear why it's so important to start early. The development that takes place during this critical window really influences a lifetime, and it's really where we have an opportunity to nurture potential, or to be honest, waste it if we don't do that. Thank you very much. And you know, at this point, it's really not simply the power of neuroscience that's pointing us to the need for greater investments in high-quality pre-K for at-risk kids, and we really have study after study that shows the benefit. What I want to do today is really focus on two different pieces of evidence I think are really important to remember. We now know that if we wait till kindergarten to address the achievement gap between kids from low-income families and their more affluent peers, we've really waited too late. There was a wonderful study that came out a couple of years ago called Inequality at the Starting Gate that looked at a national sample of children, and the information, what they found was really quite startling, is that low-income children, when you looked at sort of pre-reading and pre-math skills, were really already starting quite behind when they got to kindergarten. That achievement gap was really mostly was already in place. And what other research has already told us is that children who are behind in reading at first, second, particularly third grade, have a surprising little chance of ever catching up. And one estimate I've often heard is a 1 in 8 chance of ever returning to grade level. So we know that if we don't get kids off to the right start, the chances of them getting to getting through high school and completing high school really are quite dim. We also, at this point, have really quite strong evidence that high-quality early childhood education is the most effective strategy for closing this achievement gap. There was a great report that came out last year by The Future of Children, which is a collaboration of Brookings Institute and Princeton University. And their conclusion was that the most promising strategy for closing the achievement gap was to offer high-quality, center-based early childhood education to low-income 3- and 4-year-olds and to involve parents. So exactly the formula that we were talking about with OPK. We've already talked a little bit about the Perry Preschool Study, which has now followed these children through the age of 40. And as I mentioned at the beginning, these children were more likely to graduate, less likely to need special education and remedial education, more likely to engage as parents and have higher earnings. One estimate of the total benefits of this 2-year investment was that for a $15,000 public investment, there was a $195,000 return to the public. Now, a lot of studies have looked at this and come up with a range of numbers, but every study that's done a cost-benefit analysis of these kind of early interventions, it just shows just remarkable turns on the investment. I've actually been working on a cost-benefit study for Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten following a model that was developed by the RAND Corporation to look at returns for California. And what I found is using the RAND model is that if you send a child to OPK, the savings just to the K through 12 system, not talking about the lifetime savings or even the savings from juvenile crime, but just the savings to the K-12 system, you're already getting about $2,500 back just to the K through 12 through lower cost of remedial education, fewer children held back. So we know that even through the K-12 system, there's a really, really important savings. And what that really doesn't capture is something that Mr. Alexander mentioned earlier, which is that if you improve the educational success of children, if you improve their attitudes towards schools, then that actually relieves just a tremendous amount of burden on teachers. Is that if you talk to teachers, what they will repeatedly tell you is that they devote a disproportionate amount of time to those students who are disengaged or acting up, or et cetera. So I think there's even sort of greater efficiencies to the K-12 system that aren't being captured in those numbers.
And Representative Morgan has a question.
The study that you're doing that's based, I believe you said that it's based on a model that is pre-existing. So what you're doing with Oregon's Head Start is taking some kind of a financial payback model from a pre-existing study and applying that
to Oregon situations.
And,
yes.
And so you would assume that based on the assumptions in that base study, that those assumptions would hold also true in Oregon. So this is just a kind of a more of an academic thing rather than something that would be based on what actually has happened in Oregon.
The findings are based on an analysis of the Chicago Child Parent Centers that followed those children for 20 years.
Can you speak into the
My apologies. The analysis is that the RAND Corporation has used and that I've been following has been based on looking at a study that followed children in Chicago Child Parent Centers through the age of 20. So it's a program that's very, very similar to Oregon Head Start. The demographics are fairly similar, and there's ways of adjusting.
When was the study done?
The study began tracking those children, I believe, in either 83 or 81 or 82, and that study came out fairly recently.
And how many? What was the population of the study or the sample? How many people were in the sample?
The study involved 1,300 children. So I think about 700, about halfway divided between the test group and the comparator group. And one of the reasons that this is used, that I use this as a model, this is a program that was run through the Chicago public schools at a fairly large scale. So we're not talking about a very sort of small model program. This is really a program that we know was brought up to scale. And so I think the issues of comparison to a different kind of program are actually much better than using some of these sort of smaller model programs.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This one or another one, they closed it down. I mean, they kept that same intact group and kept watching it for the 40 years. But they stopped because ethically they were finding the difference so great so early that they didn't want to put people in a control group knowing what that meant. Is that true? Was that the study or was that a different one?
I think that may have been a different study. That may have been, I don't know if that's the Caroline Absiderian study.
That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the ethics got concerned because they were noticing how different the groups grew fairly quickly, especially in special education need.
Right, right. And in fact, that's if you're looking simply at the benefits or financial savings to K-12, it's really the special education that you see some of the greatest benefits.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you. With particular reference to Head Start in the state of Oregon, my understanding is that there's two parts of the program. There's a federally funded piece of Head Start, and then there's a piece that we fund with the state's general fund dollars.
Correct.
And those are rolled into essentially one pot of money. Can you tell us how many students we're serving right now in the state of Oregon?
We are currently serving... It's a little over 9,000. So there's about 16,000 3- and 4-year-olds living in poverty. We're reaching, between the combined federal dollars and the state dollars, we're reaching about 60% of those. Of that 60%, about 40% is coming through federal resources and about 20% is coming through state resources.
So 60% is federal and 40% is state, and you're serving about 9,000 students out of a total population of 16,000.
And I missed what you said earlier, but what I was saying of the 60%, we're serving 60% of the eligible, so 40% and 20% are the federal versus state.
So what of the 9,000 students that you're serving and the total dollars that are coming in from federal and state, what's the cost per student?
The state cost right now is, I believe, it's about 8,000. I can get you the exact number.
And does 8,000 take into account the federal funding and the state funding?
That's the state per student.
So when you add the federal funding to it, what's the cost per student?
The 8,000 is the cost per student that the state is reimbursing. The federal per student reimbursement is a little bit higher.
So we can assume then that each of these students is costing somewhere between 16 and 17,000,
yeah.
Then I'm not getting what you're trying to say here.
No. There are two funding streams that come in. One is the federal stream and one is the state stream.
Okay.
And he's indicated the amount. The cost per student overall, taking the total population that's been served in Head Start, is around 8,000 plus.
And that accounts for the federal dollars and the state dollars.
Correct.
Okay, so we're spending
money and spread it over all the students being served. It's about 8,000 per student.
And Oregon serves right now about 60% of the eligible population.
Correct.
Are there states that where are we in the grand scheme of things? When you're thinking about the percentage of the eligible population that's served, is Oregon doing really crummy, or are we doing really good? Where are we in the grand scheme of things?
We're now falling behind other states in our spending on public.
Well, in the percentage of the population that we're serving.
It's a little hard to make that comparison because a lot of the other states don't target the same way. So other states, for instance, Oklahoma preschool program is a voluntary universal preschool program. Other states use the 185% of poverty line. So it's a little, it's a little hard to give you the exact figure, but we are definitely falling behind other states in our investment in preschool. And since most state programs are targeted, they may not be targeted simply for kids in poverty, I would say that we're definitely falling behind those other states.
So are we falling behind in the amount per student or in the percentage of the eligible population?
In the percentage of the eligible population served.
So are we falling behind? I mean, I'm just trying to get some kind of relative ballpark
right.
picture here of where we are.
If the states that have really recognized the importance of pre-K are moving ahead of us fairly quickly, and there are some states that are doing a better job, a significantly better job than.
Can you speak more into the microphone, too?
Those states, and David can probably give you, I think Oklahoma's one, I think North Carolina's one, Mississippi, strangely, is one. I think some states that will recognize the impact, positive impact of early childhood intervention education, have moved rapidly ahead of us. On the material that I've read, Representative Morgan, and I haven't read as much as David, I would characterize our performance as fair in the past, but slipping behind other states. I think our program is considered by those who've looked at it to be a quality program. We probably do a better job with our Oregon pre-K Head Start than some other states do with theirs. And it might be a few bucks more expensive than some states when they look at their program. That's not a negative, but I'm a conservative guy. After I started off thinking, why are we spending that much money? I started off saying, why are we involved in this at all? This is the parents' job. So that shows how far I've come. Okay, guys. that's kind of a stat.
Will you indulge me? We also, as a state, invest a significant amount of funds into early intervention for special needs children, mm-hmm. which is in addition to the Head Start program. Do other states consider that funding as part of their state or their Head Start investment, or is Oregon not out of the ordinary in having these two programs that are focused on early childhood?
I've not heard specifically how other states deal with it. I can't speak to them, but it would be my understanding, just based on the general conversation and the material that you read, that they aren't grouping the two. They may be, but I don't know.
We are a little unusual in our state in having such a strong collaboration between the federal Head Start program and the state preschool program. What a lot of other states have done is just created another whole set of program, a whole new program with a whole new set of administration around it. So what Oregon has done, a couple of states have done somewhat similar, is that model of where we combine federal and state programs using the same performance standards and the same release delivery model.
So that is unusual?
That is unusual.
So what do most states do? They have a separate set of standards for the state-funded piece?
It's very variable. I mean, there's actually no sort of simple answer to that question. There's about 10 states left right now that have no investments in pre-K, sort of New Hampshire and then sort of some upper basin states, but it's really very diverse. I mean, Oklahoma has a program that most, as I mentioned, that focuses on four-year-olds and works through their public school system and is part of the public school funding formula. And it completely varies from state to state how the program is done.
So the other thing I was interested in was there is a lot of anecdotal information that's given to us about how crime rates are lower in places where there is more early childhood education. success rates in employment are higher. And so I'm wondering, in states that do serve more of the population than 60%, or do invest more than $8,000 per student in the program, are there significantly lower crime rates and significantly higher retention rates in the K-12 system?
Well, a lot of this expansion has really happened in the last 5-10 years. So some of those later results are a little hard to see. But one thing that this hasn't been fully vetted, but there's some strong evidence that the increase in third grade reading scores that we're seeing in other parts of the country do seem to be corresponding to some of these investments in early education.
California is said to, and some other states, to help forecast their prison cell requirement by their third grade failure rate.
Just, I think, a comment at this point. Having worked on the education budgets for quite a lot of time, the Head Start to me, from an anecdotal perspective, I think is a very successful program. And I have that experience in my own legislative district, which is, pretty low incomes, a lot of poverty, a lot of people who haven't been real successful in the education system. And I know kids and I know families who this program's made just a huge difference in their lives. And not only have the kids gotten a great leg up on the education system, but the moms have been huge success stories. And they've learned real different behavior models and learned a different kind of a way to think about the value of education. And so from that perspective, it's a great program. But when you start looking at the data and the numbers, it's really hard to try to figure out whether this is a great investment. At $8,000 per kid, we're right up about where we are in the K-12 school system.
Okay. Isn't this a half-day program?
Beg pardon?
Isn't Head Start a half-day program? It's mostly a half-day program. There are some full-day programs.
There are some services, too, Representative Morgan.
But there are a whole bunch of other things going on besides the in-the-class kind of stuff for the program. So the problem that you get to is, as a legislator, you want to do the right thing. But you also have huge competing demands for the money. And so it makes the decision about where to put the money, and it makes the ability to explain the wisdom or lack of wisdom to those investments to our colleagues a lot simpler if we really have some straight across data that we can use to show if these programs are successful. And we have in Oregon this database that we keep of students in the K-12 system. They come into the system and they get a number, and then that number stays with them as we track how they do on the statewide assessments. And putting the Head Start kids and the early childhood intervention special need kids into that system would really enhance our ability to see how those kids do as they progress through the system. And it would also serve as a fabulous tune-up tool to go and look back on those programs and figure out what can be done differently to enhance the progress of those kids through the system. And it's always been a mystery to me why there isn't a huge push within Head Start to put these kinds of programs in place, to piggyback on existing data systems so that you've got the longitudinal information that tracks how the kids are doing.
No, I think that's absolutely wonderful and really important. Just sort of the one note of caution is that whenever you're doing those kinds of data analysis, you really have to make sure that you have the right comparable comparison group. And that's often even more difficult than tracking children and maintaining the data, is that you're comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges. I mean, that's the really tricky part in all of this data analysis, is that you're really making the right comparisons between the right students. The one thing that I would also add on this is that whatever one might think of No Child Left Behind, it really means that we need to be making sure that the students who are most at risk get through the school system and get through the school system successfully. And I think this is actually a really important program for helping us achieve those kinds of goals. I mean, this is really a program that makes sure that those kids who are most at risk at school failure get the right start and are therefore have a better chance of doing well as they move through the school system.
Dr. Mandel, I know Representative Gelzer and Representative Avakian have questions for you. I wanted to ask, in the context of the number of students that we serve, 60% now of all eligible,
right.
I seem to have heard some information a while back now that regardless of that, there's still 20% of eligibles that will not take advantage of the opportunity.
That's an estimate, right? The goal is to get up to an 80% service level with
of all eligibles,
right? So the money that's being asked for full funding
would be for 80%.
Would get you up to 80%, with the idea that there are some parents who might not be willing or interested in putting their children in this kind of program. And that sort of seems to be a fairly reasonable estimate. If we look at, you know, the Abbott school districts in New Jersey, where all children are eligible, they've gotten up to around an 80% take-up rate.
So across the nation, that seems to be the standard, that to fund 80% would be considered funding 100%.
Right. I mean, okay. I think, you know, of course, you would need to revisit it and see if there are still waiting lists or that there's excess capacity, but I think that's a pretty, at this point, that's a pretty good estimate.
Thank you. Representative Morgan, you can complete your thought. And then
what's the amount of the general fund right now that is in the state's part of state fund?
I believe for the last biennium it was 55.3.
55.3 million. And what's the additional amount of the request to bring the service level up to 80%?
It's 40 million with a sort of 2-year phase into 13 million the first year, 26 million the second year.
So 55 million buys you 60%, and 40 million buys you 20%?
No, remember that 60% is including all those federal dollars. So in some sense, what this is buying you right currently is really 20% of the eligible kids.
So talk to me in apples to apples here. So right now the state puts in 55.3.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to get the additional 20%, what are we talking about in state dollars?
It would be about $26 million per year once it's fully phased in.
So
it's about
$40 million for the next biennium, $26 million the first year of the biennium, about $13 million plus the second year of the biennium to bring it up to that 80%, which we call full funded. And then
so
a sustaining rate of about $26 million going forward to hold it at that level based on the same demographics.
So let me just to make sure that I've got this straight in my head. To serve 80% of the students that are eligible, or the young kids that are eligible, will cost us just over $95 million per biennium. Is that, have I got this right, or have I not got this right?
I don't see that number.
I think that the figure that she Representative Morgan's talking about, the question was, what is the general fund allocation for Head Start right now? The response was 55.3 million. The request is for 40 million phased in 2 years, 26 and 13, to bring you up to what you consider full funding, which would be 80% of the eligibles, and adding the 40 to the 55 is 95.
Right. So it's close to doubling the state's contribution.
How many children?
Representative Gelzer.
Thank you. I think this might be more of a comment than a question, but my background actually is in early intervention, early childhood special education, and I think one of the challenges that often comes up is distinguishing between those groups of people. So am I correct that the population that Head Start and Oregon Pre-Kindergarten serves is an entirely different population than that targeted by early intervention and early childhood mm-hmm. special education.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And there is a set aside. 10% of the spots have to be set aside for children with diagnosed disabilities.
Correct, but when those students are enrolled, so if there's a child with a disability that's enrolled in Head Start, those early intervention services are provided by the Early Intervention Early Childhood Special Education Program. Correct. So when you're comparing the percentage of eligible kids, while that student, while there might be a crossover, the two universes of population are different
Correct.
Because early intervention, early childhood special ed is required to serve 100% of all
Correct.
Eligible
Right.
kids. Right. And I've wondered a little bit if it would be helpful to, I know that this is something that comes up often in sessions, to get some sort of a spreadsheet that describes the difference between Head Start, early intervention, early childhood special education, to see where they cross over and overlap and where they are very distinct programs.
Mr. Keller is on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great suggestion. Representative Avakian?
You know, I'm guessing, Madam Chair, that the doctor might cover the answers to my several questions in the remainder of his presentation, unless you're done.
I'm done. That's fine.
Okay. And I've got several questions, if I may. Just
fire away.
Thank you. First of all, you know, we're referring to you as doctor, but we don't know very much about your credentials. And could you take just 60 seconds to tell us about your educational background, a little bit about your work history?
I have a PhD in political science from the University of Chicago. So my background is less in early education, per se, but more generally in public policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been at the Children's Institute now for about 2 years.
You've done, it sounds like, considerable study, though, with regard to early childhood
yes,
development.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
What the role of the Children's Institute is less to conduct primary research on its own as to be a sort of translator of existing research. And so what we've mostly been doing is trying to find out what is the highest quality research out there available, and make that available to people like yourselves. And I mean, I have to say that the evidence on early education compared to just about any other public policy, I think it's really at this point safe to say the most soundly researched intervention that we know of.
You had mentioned earlier that about 90% of the human brain is developed prior to the age of 6. When you said that, were you talking about research that's based primarily on the physiological development of the brain?
Yes, yes.
Which would lead me to the conclusion, and I just want to pose the question, tell me if I'm wrong, that once you have that 90% physiological development by age 6, that you're greatly limited in the types of environmental factors that can affect that brain development after the age 6.
One of the things that neuroscience has been showing in the last decade is that that there are what they call windows of plasticity for different parts of the brain, that there are different parts of the brain that are really subject to environmental factors at different points in a lifetime. And if the brain doesn't get those right kinds of inputs at those right kinds of times, it's much more difficult later on to develop changes in the brain structure. The most classic example I think a lot of people are aware of is the ability to learn a second or foreign language. That sort of basically, you know, if you don't learn a foreign language, if you're not immersed in a foreign language by, I think it's age 11, I think is what the research shows, you'll never actually get the grammatical structure completely down, that the parts of the brain that deal with that kind of grammatical structure sort of close down their ability to be shaped. There's other parts of the brain that have sort of different windows of opportunity developed. And some of these windows of opportunity seem to be in this early age range.
And it's that analysis that leads you to the comments you've made that you've got to get them before the age 6 to have the greatest impact.
Right. And actually, some of the best research on this topic is actually being done right here in Oregon at the University of Oregon by Dr. Helen Neville, who's actually doing a project with Head Start children at the moment, where she's literally, shall we say, taking photos of the brain before and after Head Start.
I ask you these questions for a particular reason, and I'm getting near the end of my question. Thank you. My colleague asked some good questions about comparators. in other states, you know, and what we're doing here. And I always have to think very carefully about how we compare ourselves, because most of the 50 states have struggling school systems. And it's difficult for me to compare what we do in Oregon to other systems that may be failing or struggling in ways that we don't even know about. But the data suggesting when the brain physiologically develops, I think, is absolutely critical. And I think you would agree is supported probably by thousands of studies throughout many years of medical research. But when we have limited money like we do, and we have to decide where to target it, there are many, many proposals on where to send that money. There's proposals for full, longer school days, for year-round school, for full-day kindergarten, for all kinds of things. But what I hear based on this pattern of development in the brain is that that money is best targeted before the age of six, so that you can develop the brain in a particular manner, and that that might be a better use of the money than other models that are being presented that address issues after the age of six, such as full-day kindergarten or longer school days in high school or something like that. Is that a correct conclusion?
In fact, we have direct empirical research on that. If I go back to the Chicago CPC, the Chicago Longitudinal Study, which is just a beautiful, fabulous study, that involved both a preschool program for 3 and 4 year olds, so the equivalent of a full day kindergarten program, and an intensive first through third grade program that included reduced class sizes, and it had children who were involved in the whole program, each piece, and none of the program. So it allows you a real nice comparison of those different components. And what they found is, you know, the best results were the children who had every single one of those components. But when they did a comparison of the pre-K component versus the first through third grade part, they actually found that the biggest benefit was from the pre-K part of that. Okay. So, that, you know, there was real evidence that that if you had the intervention in the first through grade through third grade, you sustained those benefits that you got. You sustained and increased those benefits in pre-K. But if you were just to do a direct comparison of the two, they found the bigger benefit from the pre-K intervention.
And my last question, thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair, is I appreciate you being clear on that conclusion. If we're in the position we have to make choices, it sounds like you're saying the best option for taking care of all of our children is, rather than just the 60% we're addressing now, is to give them that head start in the pre-K, and then make sure that you have the programs developed in the other elementary grades so that you don't lose what you gave them in the pre-K level, and that those things should be done simultaneously. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We support the Ready for School campaign supports the continuum of, and we think the first and most important piece right now is pre-K. And then we also support full-day kindergarten at the time when it's appropriate, when you can phase it into the districts and bring it up. We're not opposed to that. We just think you can't omit this piece. And frankly, folks, and you know, we're testifying because we hope that we've done some research that can be helpful to you, and you'll determine whether it is or not. But we've spent an awful lot of time looking at this, and particularly the Crime Commission group and others. So we didn't come to this issue saying we want to make an argument for helping these kids. We really came to it saying we want to make an argument for improving our society and reducing crime and getting people better jobs and graduating from school. They're both important. But the evidence is clear that until we correct this deficiency in the education continuum, until we quit sending roughly 2,500 kids a year minimum into the system that aren't going to pass at all, that are doomed. As far as the system is concerned, they're going to drop out of school, or fail, they're going to get into trouble. Until we correct that, we can't really correct the ills of the K-12 system, because it infects the system. And it's so apparent.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I know Representative Dahlem and Roblum also have questions. Thank you for addressing the alignment piece. There is some evidence or research, I do believe, that shows that regardless of the early intervention, that there is some fall off in as the children do progress to that wonderful start that is provided to them. And I think that's an important element as well, is that the rest of the system needs to do some correcting and alignment, in, especially in literacy. And my colleagues from the Phoenix Group, if they're listening, from the Department of Education, this is a nice alignment of collaboration that we should probably be in touch with you to talk about.
Absolutely.
Representative Dahlem.
We started this committee with the notion of looking at K-20. And as I watch this presentation unfold, there's some terms that I think are confusing us. And I'm going to ask you to define these terms, because the terms in pre-K do not mean the same things they mean in K-12, and they certainly don't mean the same things they mean at the community college level. But so that, and watch my terms. If I don't give you a clear shot at it, I'll answer the questions. But we have identified... We have identified students, we have eligible students, we have served students, and we have targeted students. And those four definitions don't exist. Would you define those at least in light of pre-K? And then the last thing I'd like you to define, or tell us, or answer this question, is there equalization in pre-K as far as Head Start is concerned when it comes to funding?
Let me start with the first piece. I'm not sure that the whole question of equalization applies in the Head Start program just because it's funded so completely differently. I mean, it's a set amount. It's you know, it doesn't work through the school system, or there are a few cases where Head Start programs are applied through the school system, but it's a fairly diverse delivery system. And there are some efforts to make adjustments based on local situations, like difference in transportation costs. But I wouldn't say there's an equalization formula in the same way that this for the school system.
And that's exactly where I wanted you to go. So we have a different funding level predicated on where you happen to be born in Oregon for Head Start.
Basically, what happens is that when a request for proposal goes out for a new provider, is that they put together a proposal with a per student funding level based on estimates of cost, and whether that's there's a negotiation in that, and whether that's approved or not. So there is a process for taking into account local costs.
And the reason that I wanted to go there is Representative Morgan's question on cost per student, that we have to dig into that. We're used to K-12 talking about an equalized figure that we've tried to gravitate to. That doesn't exist in Head Start. I mean, and the variances are I think that's some of the information we have to have, because we use an overall statewide figure of $8,000 per student, but it's all over the board.
Well,
depending on what you
do. But it's also an important element to remember that it's a comprehensive program. Right? It is an early education program, but it also has connections to health and mental health services, has the parental involvement component. On average, about, I think it's about 20% of the cost is for the sort of health, mental health, service connections and provisions.
Where I'm driving with this is we have to understand the term equalization when it comes to the pieces of the silo that operate differently. I think the other terms have to be, the term targeted has to be identified. Head Start is a targeted program.
It has an eligibility requirement, and it's actually a very, very strict eligibility requirement. This is for kids living in families at or below the poverty line.
And that's why I gave you those terms to define, because if we're going to be successful, and we're going to have this discussion, we have to have the discussion of this program on its own merit. Mm-hmm. And the definition of these terms certainly clears that up for a host of us that are used to talking K-12. Mm-hmm. And used to talking, okay, we'll bump this much into the formula, this much we'll get into the system per kid, at least on the allocation side, maybe not on the spending side. So that's why the questions to define those terms, so that we understand the difference between Head Start and regular ed, K-12.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along the same line, actually, because I want an eligible student, and each state is different for Head Start. Is that right?
No. For Head Start, it is defined nationally as kids living in poverty. State programs, most states at this point have developed pre-K programs of their own, and those state programs are very, very different in their eligibility requirements. And in fact, there's a sort of a national debate going on right now about whether pre-K should be a targeted program for the most at-risk populations, or whether we should think about some kind of voluntary universal program. There's now strong evidence that there are benefits pre-K to just about all children. There's some really nice research coming out of Oklahoma showing that. If we move in that direction, then you might, you know, if one were talking about universal pre-K, you're also then probably talking about a very different kind of program than Head Start, that wouldn't necessarily have this sort of full complement of comprehensive services that are so important for this at-risk population that we're talking about. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. I mean, so because you had mentioned other states have 185% of poverty, anything above that 100%, the federal government is not going to be a part of that at all.
Right. And you know, in a number of states, their pre-K program is completely distinct from Head Start.
Oh, okay. And that, the last question.
Okay.
Do you know how many children, then, given that information, how many children that we have in that age group? I guess that's 3 and 4 year olds. Exist in Oregon. We say 16,000 are the ones that are in the eligible population.
I have that written down. Can't remember it off the top of my head. If divide by 0.174 and you get that number.
That's a very large number, because that's about...
Yeah, if we're talking about all children, right? So, you know, we have 16,000 3 and 4 year olds living in poverty. That's 17.4%. I think that's
so about
based
1/8.
On...
Yeah, okay. A little bit bigger.
Representative Barker and then Representative Kahn.
Thank you. I just had a question about the 20% that don't take part in that. Are these being people in poverty, are some of them not doing it because they're doing something else, or they're just not interested, or I mean, or do they have, like, maybe they're in their own preschool or their church or something? What do we know?
There's a lot of different reasons. I mean, I think it's partially, you know, as I said, just parents who want their kids to be at home, or you know, in some cases it may be parents who aren't fully aware of the program yet. We can't answer yet that question in Oregon because we haven't gotten up to that level. I mean, we're at the point where every single Head Start program in the state has a waiting list. So.
Okay.
You know, that 80% number is really based on experiences in other places with similar targeted programs.
National information. Nothing in the national data that would define that 20% group for lack of participation.
You know, I think it varies for the reason
various
why.
Social factors.
Yeah, various social factors why. You know, it may be the case that in Oregon we'll find that we have even more parents that want to participate in the program. I think that would be wonderful if we got to that point and discovered that. But to be honest, that's a little bit, you know, you have to get to the point where you have more funding to even figure that out. All we know is that there are now many more parents who want their children to be in the program than can participate. And that's very clear from our experience.
Representative Comp, then Representative Dahlem.
Thanks, Chair Flores. I only have one question. It's a transparency question. You know, the chalkboard and the Oregon Department of Education have been working very hard to show where expenditures are for school districts. Is there a website or some place that we want to go and see how the funding is being allocated, particularly when we have multiple issues like mental health and that sort of thing?
Right.
Is there some place we can go to see how that looks?
I mean, I would go to the Oregon Department of Education's Head Start Collaboration Office, and I know that each program, you know, has financial audits and must provide that information.
So that's where we'd find it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And Representative Comp, Mr. Keller can provide us the information that he has been able to develop from the Head Start
task force.
Okay, great.
Or provide that for our, inform our thinking. Representative Dolan.
Now, probably tying together Representative Crump and Representative Barker's statements and questions, do we have any way of, I know in our community, both in Madras and the Dalles, we have a migrant ed program that runs a parallel Head Start program. First, are those people accounted for, and is that some of the 20%?
I believe that's counted separately, but I'd have to double check on that.
I know we do have a Head Start parent here today, yeah, too, but I'm not closing you off. If you have any final thoughts you'd like to provide for us, we know, before we have our final question here.
Yeah. One question, just to ask, do you know what the share, the amount of money the federal government puts into Head Start in Oregon annually or biannually?
At this point, it's about twice what the state is putting in. It's a little more than, a little more than twice.
Yes,
they're both paying for twice as many children as the state, and they're paying a little bit more per child.
Okay. Do you know what amount per child more?
I believe it's about 9,000. It's about 9,000.
And we don't think it's likely that that will be increased.
Currently, the state per child is 85% of the federal.
Okay, he's educating me a little bit on the calculus, and I think I'm going to need some help here.
He sat through this once before.
Yeah, if there are no more questions, we just want to thank you very much for giving us some time. We know that your committee was focused on the K-12 issue, and we commend you for that. And I particularly would suggest to Representative Morgan, who stepped out, who's asked a lot of questions relative to budgeting, and I understand that, but this is an issue whose time has come. It's an issue that probably we should have been dealing with over the years. And it's an issue that should come to the education table with the same standing in all the other elements of education. It is the single best investment in education that we can make in the state. Dr. Mandel didn't mention that when the Minneapolis branch of the Federal Reserve wanted to determine how they could improve the economy of the region, they asked their economists to take a look at that. And they went out and did a study, and they came back, and their suggestion was that the most cost-effective way to improve the economy of the region, and the way that would give the greatest payback over time to the region in the economy of it, was early childhood education. Not building football stadiums or putting up new hotels and meeting centers. Early childhood education. Right on the button. Yeah, I mentioned to you when I started that the Jim Heckman study, the Nobel laureate that studied at the University of Chicago, if you remember that comment, 29% of these kids from these disadvantaged homes are likely to graduate from high school. You double that with Head Start. And if you get parental involvement in Head Start, it can go as high as 85% according to his study. I mean, this is a serious investment that affects the quality of life in this state going forward. This is an open wound in education here in the state of Oregon. It truly is. It's an open wound. These children have no advocacy. They've needed someone like you or others to step forward and say, we have to do something about this. And I really suggest to this committee that they give strong consideration to doing something about it.
Thank you very much for the information. And I also would just like to underscore your comment that I know that Head Start has various components, but especially the literacy element of that. Having just returned from a forum of national experts, mm-hmm. and the empirical evidence that is suggested and supported there, that this is truly an economic development consideration, and that in the long term and on the continuum on the education process, that there are, you know, the social services component, the corrections component, that it is definitely a mitigating factor to the other end.
Thank you.
So.
Absolutely true.
Thank you very much.
If I may, Madam Chairman, before I go, this piece in your packet is the members of our statewide Ready for School Leaders Panel. And if you'll take a look at it when you have a chance, there's some really good citizens from the state that have come together around this issue. Not a one of them, as I use the term, has a dog in the fight. They're purely in it because they think it's the right thing to do in this state. Not one of them will make a quarter, no matter what your committee or any other body of the legislature decides. They're strictly just concerned citizens. Now, organizations that are endorsing the Ready for School campaign include Associated Oregon Industries, which has made it its highest educational priority, Children First for Oregon, Citizens Crime Commission, City Club of Portland, Fight Crime, Invest in Kids in Oregon, Innovation Partnership, the Oregon Business Association, Oregon School Employees Association, the Oregon Education Association, Stand for Children, and, of course, the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Those are people who have formally come behind this campaign and endorse it. So we leave you with good thoughts about young people, and we want to bring a mother from a parent of a Head Start young lady or a child up to visit with you. Do you have a moment for them?
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for your consideration.
Thank you. Look forward to hearing further from you as well. Corey, is it Bruin?
Corey Bruin. Yeah.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, Madam Chair and the committee, first I'd just like to say thank you so much for letting me come up and give my testimony, because it's something that's really important to me. Head Start is really important to me and has made a huge difference in my life.
Well, we're excited to have you here, and we'll have you start by giving us your name for the record, even though I've already said it.
My name is Corey Bruin, and I'm a Head Start parent, and I am also a mother of four and an in-home child care provider. So I kind of get the opportunity to see children, well, on all different levels and all different ages, from like 6 weeks old to 12 years old anyway. So, and I have noticed a huge difference between the kids that have been in my daycare and the kids that are in my family that have been in Head Start and those that haven't. So it's kind of a unique opportunity for me. First, I just want to introduce you to my family.
Okay.
This right here is my current Head Start student. This is Isaiah, and he's in his second year of Head Start this year. Very excited to start again.
And how old?
He is 4 years old. He's almost five in like a week and a half. So he just misses the cutoff date for going into kindergarten, but actually I'm very happy because it's another year of preparation, and so it's a good thing. This is Noah. He was in Head Start a couple years ago. He took 1 year of Head Start. He started out as a child that very sweet and loving towards everybody he knew, but he also had a very hyper and energetic side. I'll put it that way. He was diagnosed with ADHD and ODD, and when I was pregnant with him, there were issues of abuse and stuff. So he was also suspected right before he had started Head Start. Since he's so young, they couldn't say for sure, but he was suspected bipolar. So he had some really tough stages that he went through, and I'll explain how Head Start was a great help to that as well.
How old is he now?
He is now 6 years old, so, and he's in first grade, and he is doing excellent. In fact, his older brother, which is right here, who did not go to Head Start, Jimmy, he didn't go to Head Start. However, I was able to scrape together some money for him to go to a private preschool, and with the help of my parents. And actually, Noah, who had all of these issues before he started Head Start, has actually better grades just since the beginning of the year than Jimmy did. And Jimmy also had preschool, but it was not a Head Start program. It was a private program. And both of them were great, but it's just another thing that I'm proud of. So, yeah. And then this is my future Head Start child, Josiah. He just turned 2 years old in August, and he is a handful. So he's a little bundle of energy. So anyway, when I'm talking, I don't know if it helps just to have some faces to kind of go behind, but That's my family.
Beautiful family.
Thank you. Past and present and future Head Start children. So, also, I like to refer to them as at least three of the children, and I believe four, excuse me, children who I feel will not need all of the intervention later because they've had the prevention that they have been provided through Head Start. So, yeah, I believe that Head Start is an ounce of prevention that far outweighs all of the future intervention that's needed later. So, yeah. When I started Head Start with Noah, I started out as, I didn't really know what Head Start was. I kind of thought that Head Start was like a program for just mentally disabled children. I grew up with, you know, you always heard about the short yellow bus and the Head Start bus, and I was totally, I didn't know what Head Start really was. Also, I'm an in-home child care provider, and before I opened up my own in-home daycare, I actually worked in some local child care centers at the Y and Learning Tree as a teacher and stuff, and I always had my kids with me, and I didn't really trust anyone with my children. I was like, I'd like to have my eyes on my children. Eventually, I decided that it was just too hard to have my children in the same building while I was watching other people's children, but not my own. So I decided to open up my own in-home daycare so I could take care of my own children. And because, once again, I did not trust them with anybody. Once Noah got to the age of being eligible for, age-wise eligible for preschool, I got to thinking about it, and I was like, well, you know, I'll look into Head Start just because I feel he had a lot of issues with communicating with others, with behavior, and a doctor that I was talking to, he suggested, well, maybe you should look into Head Start because, you know, it'd be a great socializing tool and they can help you and it's a great resource for your situation. So I did look into Head Start and reluctantly I put him in, and I decided right there from the beginning that if I was going to have my child in Head Start, I was going to be involved in any way I could. I was going to have my eyes on those teachers and I was going to know exactly what they were teaching my children and stuff like that. Right from the get-go, I was very shy, but right away I had very open and caring teachers and staff, family educators, other people that were very open and caring to my situation and my family. And they pulled me in, I guess I could say, and I began getting involved from that point. I've been involved on the parent site committee, and from there I was voted on to the policy council. From there I was actually voted on to the Community Action Agency Board of Directors. So I now sit on the board of directors, and this is my third year there. So I've had the opportunity to see how the agency works and see how Head Start truly can affect families from a lot of different aspects. As a parent, I've been able to have the opportunity to be involved in hiring committees, selection criteria committees, grant review committees, budget committees, and I was also voted the OHSA state representative last year for our area. So I've had a lot of opportunities through there as well. Also with fundraising committees, and I helped spearhead some letter writing campaigns. But most of all, obviously, I was more opened up into the opportunities that are available to me as a parent to be involved in my children's lives, not just now, but in the future. And all aside from the education aspect, those were the things that affected me. It gave me a higher self-esteem. It gave me a better outlook towards my future. I'm a single parent. I've been married twice and divorced twice. Not something that, you know, I love to go and spread around. However, everything that's happened in my life has been a learning opportunity. And I've also come to realize through a variety of things that everything that happens to me and every decision I make affects my children. And this is one decision that I was able to make for my children and putting them in Head Start that I believe is going to affect my children and myself and my family and society as a whole in a much better way. Aside from the education, just the education aspect of it, for my children who have been in Head Start, they have developed higher self-esteem, more confidence, kind of a go-get-em attitude. They actually love the fact that I'm involved at their school, and they love to do the activities and stuff with me. And they're like, my mommy's, you know, on the committee for our class and stuff like that. And that makes me feel really good. But it also lets me see that even children that young can still see, you know, the difference that it makes that the parents are involved. And it raises their self-esteem, which helps them be more involved in their classroom because they see mommy's involved. And they're learning more. And they're going to be more prepared when they go on into K through 12. They also have learned important communication skills, social skills, and then, of course, the literacy piece and all the other pieces that, of course, you know, that we always talk about with Head Start. But the nice thing, the unique thing about Head Start that makes it unique to other programs or other areas of education is that Head Start does not just educate and empower the children, but it also educates and empowers the families, which is a lot different than some other areas of education. And that's one thing that I feel is so important. It's actually starting from the whole family unit and building up from there. It's not just pointing in towards the kid. And I believe that one of the most important pieces of changing society isn't just reaching the children, but also reaching the families. And Head Start is unique in the fact that it offers English classes to Spanish-speaking families. It offers computer training completely free to the families. And a lot of it's done just, it's not necessarily done, all of it, not all of it is done with Head Start dollars, but it's done by people who truly care and volunteers, you know, that are willing to come into the classroom and teach the families and teach the children about dental hygiene, personal safety, you know, stuff like that that parents might not necessarily be able to do on their own with their children. it's taught my children skills with sharing, behavior control, also toothbrushing, something as little as that. Just a good example of one of the things that Head Start, you know, does. And they actually teach the children to be aware of all different areas of their life and, you know, to actually value themselves and take care of themselves and keep themselves safe and pay attention in class and stuff like that. Just important things that children need to know. Head Start has truly, truly become a part of my family. They've allowed me to build my confidence up, and they've allowed me to step forward and be involved in my other children in their school now that they are onto other grades and they're no longer in Head Start. I've, you know, started becoming more involved in their school, and I cannot say enough. I have so many things inside my head that I want to say, but, you know, it would take me all year to say them. So I just would really like to get across how important Head Start has been to me, and I know that there are tons and tons of other parents just like me that have their own stories that they could tell, and Head Start is not just an issue, you know, that's floating out there, that's something that we talk about funding and all that kind of stuff, but Head Start is actually a reality for a lot of families that would normally not get the chance to have these people in their lives and have these chances in their lives to actually get involved in their children's lives now rather than later. And I guess one quick thing, illustration that I'd just like to say is when you're going on a trip or whatever and you're taking your car, you're not going to, you know, worry about things as they come up. You're going to get the oil checked before you go. You're going to fill the tank up with gas before you go. You're going to make sure you have everything that you need for the trip while you're there. And as hokey as it sounds, you know, it's all about preparation. And rather than having to deal with your car breaking down later because you didn't have enough water in it or, gas or something, or you having to take care of a problem later because you didn't pack something you needed, in a sense, children are kind of the same way. It's like if you don't have the training before you go in to take a test, if you don't study, then you're not going to do any good. And I kind of think that future education for our children is kind of like a test. You know, while we're in school, we're kind of protected. We have teachers to help us. We can learn all that kind of stuff. But then we're released out into the world, and what we've learned in school, if we didn't feel either confident enough in the classroom, or we weren't paying enough attention, or we were not prepared when we went into that classroom to begin with, we don't pick up the skills and the things that we need to move on with our life and to be successful citizens in society. So, so important. There's so much I could say. But anyway.
Well, you've done an effective job of communicating your support, and I really, really appreciate that. Would you like to have some questions from anyone who might
have
them?
That'd be great. I don't mind at all.
Members?
Just a big thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. Thank you very much for letting me
Thank you for sharing your perspectives and your insights. It
Definitely.
Does help put a face on it. And you do have a beautiful family.
Thank you.
And we wish you all success.
Thank you very much.
And who's taking care of your in-home children today?
Actually, my assistant.
Okay.
my assistant and my friend, she's helping me out. So.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Committee? Okay, there is nothing further on our agenda. Then you will be advised of our next meeting in the event or as the agenda evolves. And if you have any questions, I know Mr. Keller will be getting a lot of information together for us as a result of what we've found today. Be sure to give your forms to Mr. Keller. And with that, we stand adjourned.